Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. Fantastic seeing so many of you here. We're, as you might have heard, a full house. In fact, we're overflowing. So I hope you're all sitting comfortably. And I'm going to open the conference. And in the traditional way that we do that, we're going to light the conference candle. So it falls on me to welcome you all. I'm Paul Fillmore. I took over as chairman last summer, and so welcome again. You might have noticed there's people walking around with red spots on their badges. We're here to help, so people who are members of the board or other people, presidents, vice presidents, if you see a red spot and there's anything you need, come and talk to us. We're here to make your stay enjoyable. I'm just going to introduce you and welcome you to the network itself. As you know, we started right back in 1973. And in fact, the first the first Mystics and Scientists was in that the network took over was in 1978. And I have Jenny Blake to thank to remind me about that. Jenny, who's here somewhere, I hope, in the back, who's a very good friend from right back then. And I think we took over the Mystics and Scientists from the Reakin Trust. I think we'd been running in parallel. And one of our first presidents was unwell. And so the organisation was moved to Ockley House, George Blaker's house, and Jenny was very much involved in the administration. And the fantastic thing is we're now on the 39th Mystics and Scientists. So welcome to that. I just want to introduce you to some developments, because one of the things about the network is we try and evolve. And I'm going to introduce you to a little bit of the technology. And we're going to try some different things this weekend. So one of the things you might see is you're sitting in a strange format, because we very much value you as members and you as members becoming involved. And we'd like you to become involved even more, because this is your network. So you might have seen our website, and we have to welcome our main speakers, but just to point out, because a lot of people have pointed out to me that they've just noticed that in fact Vera unfortunately is indisposed, so people were saying, well, who's taken over? So there's Maya, we're very pleased to have, and we only really found out a couple of days ago. In fact, I only found out through, I think, 2 days ago. And so last night we've updated information. So if you want to look on the website and find out a little bit about her, and we also have a link to her website. And you would probably want to click on the English part. So a lot of people had said, oh, but I've been looking online to see what's happening and who the speakers are. Well, the information is there, so please do look. There's a lot of developments happening associated with the network. And apart from we have new office and we have new staff, so somewhere we should have hiding probably is Chiara. Not hiding, it's Chiara.
Hello.
So if you phone the network office, you'll be probably saying hello to Chiara, and she's been absolutely fantastic organising everything. And we also have Rodrigo in the back, who is also very much supporting our office and a lot of our new developments. Now, one of the things we've got, and you have links in your programme package, is a link to a new website called Explore, and that's actually going to become part of our main SMN website. We hope that will be up and running We've got a tentative date, I think, of 1st of May. But at the moment, we have to type in a new URL called explore.scimednet.org. And you'll notice there's a lot of things that you can click on. If you click on networking and we click groups, what we'll find is some new ways to communicate and talk and discuss and share information. And so those of you who are IT literate and like trying these things out, we'd very much like you to try this. So one of those groups is called Mystics and Scientists 39, because obviously it's our 39th one. And we have space here for documents, but the key thing here is something called forum. If we click on that, then we have a number of different areas in which you can make comments and come up with ideas and discuss things. And one of the things we would like you to try is to elect one person on your table who would like to put some information on the appropriate forum. So if we walk down here, there's David Lorimer's talk discussion area. And so those are tables who would like to come up with a few bullet points. You can put down here table one and some of your comments. And we will develop some thoughts and some ideas from all of you. So we want to hear from you. If your table decides you don't like this sort of thing and you want to write it on paper and hand it in to somebody, then you can do that as well. There is also an area called the conference feedback. And so we're trying out new things. If there's something you don't like, let us know. Or if there's something you do like, even more important, let us know so we can try out new ways of collaborating. Also, we've got an area which is called the position paper development area, and I'm very keen on that, and other people still wondering if it's going to work or not. But I would like an outcome from all our main conferences for everybody who's involved, who comes to develop a paper as a group, and where we pick up key themes, and if there's certain ideas that come out, like wouldn't this be a fantastic area that needs research or something like that, then we will have an output to publish in the network and also to push very, very hard to the wider community. Okay, this is important. We've got a lot of people here, and so we've got a lot of power. It's not just the head, but it's the heart as well, obviously. And we would like to try and somehow capture that and see how we can bring that into the much wider domain and make suggestions and see what we can develop. So that's an experiment. So there is an area, as I said, for each of the, after each discussion area, so you can put your comments on. Now, hopefully all of you did receive an email which said, come and join the Mystics and Scientists group, and probably a week or two ago. You do need to have said and accepted the invitation for you to be able to see the group. So if you haven't done that, you will have to email us and we'll get busy overnight. Or perhaps you can find your old email, which will probably... Is Richard here? It'll come from Webmaster or something? It'll either come from Richard Irwin or Webmaster. So you can look up and accept that invitation and then you will have access to the group. Okay, so I hope I haven't lost people too much with the technology, but we want to try different ways of collaboration and discussion and synthesis, etc.
There'll be some people who haven't brought their computers and they want to make a comment. How do they do it?
Well, I believe there's a business center here, but I'm not quite sure. If it was a couple of, is there, Rodrigo? Do we have access? We have. So there are some computers that people can go and use.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Great. Well, that's that answered. Thank you. Okay. Well, that's enough for me. I will now hand over to our president, Peter Fenwick, to introduce the conference.
Well, thank you very much. Can you all hear okay? Great. Well, welcome. Amazing. Absolutely wonderful. Lots of great positive energy and wonderful people who have come here. So let me welcome you all to this conference because it is, in my view, an enormously important one. But first of all, let's just see where we all come from. Who comes from England? Okay. Who comes from Scotland? Just. Well, four. Who comes from Wales? One, two. Okay, well, you've got a lot of work to do in Wales and Scotland to get more people to come. Who comes from, let's just say, Europe? Yep, not many. America? Yes. Great. Australia? No. Japan? No. Okay, so we're mainly all English. So the reason that I'm so excited about this conference is that it's in an area which is about to grow and expand in a most enormous way. The idea of non-locality, we're all one thing. Non-locality moves straight on to non-duality, which is the impetus, not of science, but of consciousness research. So the two fields are very closely linked. So it's enormously exciting, enormously important. Of course, quantum mechanics is involved, and many of you will have heard the story of a diner, I think, Larry, it was in America, who knows. And a man came in and ordered an ice cream, and they gave him one, and he said, could I have another one, pointing to the seat beside him, and he said yes, and gave him that. And of course, nobody came to the seat, and so the guy ate it. Came back the next week and did the same again, and after about 3 or 4 months of this, the guy who ran the diner said, why do you always get two? And he said, well, you see, I'm a quantum physicist, and I know that all these atoms above me may suddenly, excitingly, turn themselves into a beautiful girl who'll be sitting there. Not only that, I'm going to fall madly in love with her, and it's going to be a really happy story. So the guy looked at him, gave him his two ice creams. And then he thought, look, why on earth are you waiting for the universe to give you a girl magically? We have lots of single girls who come in here, very pretty. Why don't you get one of those to sit beside you and you can fall madly in love with them and it'll be perfect? And the guy looked at him and said, fat chance of that. But nevertheless, the impact that our science at its cutting edge is having on our current ideas are amazing. And one of the things I would like to do is just to give you a feel for the sort of way we're going, particularly in non-locality. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just show you a couple of slides of the work which we've been doing and which we're going to present in Tucson. So Paul will very kindly put them up for me. And you'll see a word there, which is called hyperscanning. Now, many of you, how many of you have heard the word hyperscanning? Hey, virgin territory, apart from Larry. Hyperscanning is, in fact, having two people under the same analysis system. So as you see, I'll put EEG there so you can have hyperscanning electrically, or you can do it with fMRI, which is blood flow in the brain, or you can do it through many other methods. And in fact, now the hyperscanning literature is just starting. It really started to come online in 13, 14, there were more papers, and 15, there are more papers still. And one of the exciting things is that we're not limited by space in a way that one is. And there have been people who have run fMRI on one side of the West Coast and another one in the center of America and tied them together and done experiments between people at that sort of distance. And it's teaching us quite different things about ourselves. Now, I'm showing you a hyperscanning experiment there, and what you can see is myself and one person there with their cap on, another person there with their cap on. Now, they're all connected up to the machines. So what we're doing is we can take their brain function in real time. Can I have the next slide? And one of the amazing things that we find is that we are no longer individuals. And what you guys may think, that you are little islands, you're not. And if you do the right statistics, what you can see, there's somebody giving light, Alan on the left, and the student is on the right. This is the student's brain. And these are all electrodes. Student is looking that way, and the teacher is looking this way. And the student, at this frequency, quite slow, is in fact driving the teacher's brain. Not isolated. It's actually driving the teacher's brain. And now we can see at a different frequency, the teacher, from various parts, is driving part of the student's brain. So how on earth does this happen? You can see at higher frequencies, the student again is having a conversation with the brain of the teacher. Next slide. You can see that the teacher is having a small conversation with part of the student's brain. Now, these are secure statistically. Now, the interesting thing is we are looking at light, light given by spiritual people. How many of you, and I expect a scattering, but no more, how many of you have been in the presence of a spiritual teacher and seen light? Hey, that's really good. It's more than I expected. Okay, well, the question is, what is the mechanism of that? And this is something which we were setting out to try and find. And so the next thing we did, can I have the next slide, is to put goggles in front of the teacher. You can see them there. See? He's got a diffusing screen in front of his glasses. And so what happens to this communication between the brains of each of them? Next slide. Nothing. It all goes. It all goes. So what we're saying is that a lot of this is something to do with information which is transferred via the gaze. We all know that the gaze is terribly important, but what you didn't know is that in actual fact, you are driving the brains of the other people. Now, this is called hyperscanning, and it's going to be something which is going to be much more popular and will be mainstream for a little while. But it's going to lead on to something else, and you can't actually stop it now. And that is that if you can do this just in one laboratory, you can separate people now easily because they're information networks. You can get to the position of seeing how non-locality actually works. And that's why I think it's so important, and that's why I think that we should, why this conference is at a really good time. Anybody got any questions about hyperscanning? Or any questions? Yeah.
Peter, do you have any source of papers that we can read on the subject?
On hyperscanning?
Yes.
Absolutely. I've been scouring the literature, particularly in relationship to gamma and the EEG. Send me an email, ask me, and if you don't get a reply, you know what you do. You send it again and ask me, did you get a reply? And so, yeah, I'm very pleased to let you have them. Yeah?
Why did the student have more impact on the brain?
Why go via brain mechanisms? It's, I don't know, it's interesting. He was a particularly good student. We've got one student who's particularly bad, and he doesn't interrogate the teacher's brain nearly as much. So it seems as if good students, in fact, are having more of a brain communication. But since it's only three people...
Please explain what the actual mechanism of transmission was. What did the student and the teacher have to do? Just stare at each other?
Yes, I didn't explain the experimental situation. This has all come about because I was interested in light. And so these are light-giving sessions. And the question is, how do people who are given light by the teacher, how do they modify their behavior? And how do they get the experiences, first of all, of light? And secondly, how does the modification occur? And it's going to turn out to be something like this. When light is given, you can see the way the brains work. And I think this is a tutoring system. And there are various areas in the brain which are activated by it. And that is the occipital cortex, where you see the light, and the fusiform gyrus, where you see colors. But there's something else which is... enormously important there. And that is that if you take a camera and take a photograph of the guy giving light, you can't see it. He has a perfectly normal photograph, so it's not photons, it's something else. And it looks as if it's an actual change in brain mechanism. So it's interesting. So choose a teacher who's really good, and then you can interlock brains. Yeah. I think it's fascinating because there are a whole set of phenomena here. One of them, I've been talking about light, but the people who perceive the light also perceive energy. The energy runs up and down their body, and it clearly isn't affected by the goggles in the way that light is. So I think they're different mechanisms, but it's only really just beginning.
May I?
Yeah.
Peter, as you may know, I've been on the receiving end of this process, as I know you have. Now, what's interesting is that when Alain embarks on this transmission, he would say, like everybody does in this field, have your mind empty, be open to reception of what is happening, and then the other things. So it seems to me that the transmission is actually intentionally set up from the teacher to the student. Therefore, I find the idea of the student controlling. The only question is the student's state will perhaps control the degree of receptiveness and the quality of the reception, but he's not actually controlling the brain. He's just either letting the signals through or stopping them, depending on where his brain is at. Would that be fair?
That is fair, because we did a 4x4 table, teacher giving, student receiving, teacher giving, student not receiving. Teacher not giving, student receiving, teacher not giving, student not receiving. And you can block it with your mind. If you're not receiving it, then the amount of coupling goes down enormously.
And that would explain the idea that the student is controlling the teacher's brain.
It would go to the idea that you need a quiet mind if it's going to be affected. Yeah. Yes.
Education works. If this is true, then what happens in the school between the teacher and the student is totally different from what you think it is.
You are so right, and you've perceived the whole thing. The point is that the kids will go into class, they'll have electrodes put on their heads, and this sort of thing will go on amongst the whole class. And in fact, there is a paper on looking at games being played. It's only just come out. And this shows that you can pick up relationships between different people's brain function if they're playing win and lose games. And so it can only go one way, and that is that if one can help people learn more quickly, I expect somebody will use it to do this by getting their brain activity, analysing it and seeing what's happening. Yeah, I'm sure you're right. Yes. Links with?
Absent healing.
Oh, absent healing. Oh, we're right in that territory now, which is so exciting. Because... Yeah. But you... Yes, you're absolutely right, because you all know about the fMRI scan. And in Hawaii, was it? Larry, was it Hawaii?
Yes, Gene Okerberg.
Yes.
Using native healers in Hawaii to influence people at a distance while they were having their brain
being scanned. So that's the first side of it. Now, of course, what they will do is they'll put the healers in a scan as well. Yeah. One will have a much better understanding of what happens. So at long last, these sort of rather fringe ideas will come mainstream. They have to, because the technology is there.
Yeah. Sorry, so Tom, did you test the hypothesis that the photons are perfectly real photons and are actually coming from the faces of the two people? Because we know that there's massive bandwidth into the prefrontal cortex from reading human faces, yeah. And it seems to me that would be consistent with your blurring cutting off the effect of communication. What happens if you turn the lights off?
Tom, this is... This is so exciting. And it's exciting because one of the things that we did was to do those experiments. One was to do it in bright light, and it facilitated it. And the other was to do it in darkness, and it all went down. So it was as if you need light for the process. And... The only way that I could see that you need light for a process like that, and you can help me, is because it is in fact a cortical phenomenon. And so what you're doing with extra light is you're firing up the cortex, and then that model would work. But if there are photons there, how are we going to detect them?
Well, but wouldn't that be consistent with you requiring reflected or scattered light? And seeing enough of it to detect very tiny facial gestures, which are a fabulously rich way of communication.
Everything yes, okay. So essentially, it's the same model, is it? So it's going by a facial gesture. It's not going by biophotons. Because I'd love it to go by biophotons. Wouldn't that be amazing? Yes.
Without being too critical, but this is not normality. This is an experiment. Very much local.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The way I've put it to you, it is absolutely local. It is, in fact, stretching out what a local experiment can turn into. But it will turn very quickly into non-locality, because you'll have healers at a distance, coupled, and you'll be able to see it in a way that you could never before. So non-locality, I think, the investigation and use of non-locality will change. Yeah.
So at the base level, are you talking about a correlation between
FFTs? Okay. Sorry, this is not going to be brilliant for everyone. Do you know about Granger causality? Okay. Take a number of channels and run a correlation on them. And then, of course, you can say how much they're correlated, but that's of little interest because we don't want to do that. What we want to find out is what channel leads which. And this is done via a mechanism called Granger causality. But that has recently been found not to be a very good method, and so the method we use is something called phase slope index. So it's a much better statistic, and it actually gives us the driving channels. So we're no longer in the domain of just correlation. We're in the domain of driving or causation. And if you'd like the papers on it, I can send them to you. If you're going to ask me to explain them to you, find the mathematician. Any other questions? Oh, look, we're about to begin. Well done, David. Well, let me introduce David Lorimer to you, who's been prominent in the network really since 1973, is it, 74?
No, 86.
86. And he was director of the network at one time. David and I worked very closely together. David is an amazing person. You've seen the numbers of reviews he's done in Network. And you might ask the question, does he really read the books? And the answer is he does. And how do I know? Because I've seen books which he's reviewed and they've all got little marks in them, things which he feels are important. Unless he just goes through his books marking them at random, it's highly unlikely. So he does. Speaks fluent French and German. And he has recently had a most amazing program for teaching children values. And that's the Inspire Aspire program. And that, how many kids? 20,000 in it now, David.
Oh, much more than that.
Oh, 30.
No, I mean, we've reached over 200,000, with the program in the last 7 or 8 years.
It's absolutely astonishing. What I'm really looking forward to is to see the statistics in those who've been through David's program and those who haven't after 10 years or something. Are you doing that?
Well, it's a separate research project. So, I mean, we are being researched, but not exactly with that question.
Yes. Well, I think it's absolutely fantastic. Anyway, David, it's a great pleasure to have your talk, which is empathic resonance. Hey, goes right in. Non-locality and the universal mind. Thank you, David.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Peter. Thank you. Well, welcome, everybody. It's very nice to see you all here at the 39th Mystics and Scientists, which means next year is the 40th anniversary conference. And I can tell you already that we have Fritjof Capra and Ravi Ravindra lined up and other people to the pipeline. So fairly shortly, you'll get some news of next year's conference as well. But anyway, we haven't had this year's conference yet, so let's get on with that. I'm not going to do my own. Do you want to? Yeah, okay, great, yes.
Finger on the button.
Yep, on you go. I wanted to start with a piece of music, which some of you may have heard. I was put onto this by a friend of mine, Christopher Thompson, in Scotland, who himself is a very fine pianist. And this is a Hungarian called Georgi Sebok, and he plays the Adagio from Bach's Toccata, Adagio, and Fugue in C major, which is BWV 564, for those who like these kind of things. And so we're going to swap out of this into the web page, and he talks a little bit about his life, and then he plays this piece, and I think you'll find it rather extraordinary.
There was a time that I was suffering from not suffering. You know, I had the feeling that I inhibited all my feelings and my reactions to anything, not just music. One had to overcome all kind of feelings, primitive ones like fear or being in danger of life many times. The aim was not to really feel deeply that. The aim was the opposite. The aim was to survive, and the price of surviving is not to feel. And that not to feel, sooner or later, includes music itself. And then after the war, life started again. And I had the feeling that music is obviously something wonderful, but the connection to the essence of it was lost. I knew, obviously, it's wonderful, it's beautiful. Acknowledging of beauty or greatness, but then I played that transcription. And after the long toccata comes. I felt something very strange. My throat. Some strings, they were not functioning, started to vibrate. Thank you.
Well, perhaps I ought to stop there. You can feel the intensity of emotion and beauty and exquisite vibration, you know, coming through that piece. At least I hope you could. I mean, every time I listened to it, and then you see the expression on his face. If you were just watching the expression on his face, you could see that everything was, the music was just flowing right through him. And that's one of the things I find just wonderful about listening to Bach, played by people who really understand how to play it, like Georgi Sebok and Rosalind Turek and a few others. So that's really a kind of introduction to a sense of resonance. Empathetic resonance is a term that I coined when I was writing my book, Hole in One, in the early 90s or late 80s. And we can go on to the next one. And the next. And I just had a little image there of resonance, which I found earlier on, so we can continue. So the waves, like the music that you heard, the waves just coming over you, and like that. So this talk is based on a book that I published in 1990, with the most awful cover. I suggested the concept for the cover, and then they produced something really ugly. And there was something like a sort of dead baby skeleton in the middle here. And I said, I can't have that. And they said, we can't start again. No, so we have to go with this cover. We'll change the middle. And so they put this white dot in the middle, which is slightly better. Anyway, the idea was to suggest wholeness, oneness. And as I'm a golfer, some people wondered whether I put an extra W in there by mistake. And those of you golfers will have seen some extraordinary golf last weekend. And it was based on the Life Review and the Mystical Experience. And it takes me back to 1983, which was one of the first Mystics and Scientists. The first one I came to was 1981, which was Mystics and Scientists 4. And it was chaired by Malcolm Lazarus. It was a very, very good chairman, and he initiated these conferences. And when you go to a conference like this for the first time, and I was absolutely electrified by the content, and there was a lot of Ken Wilber and all these exciting people. They were just coming onto the scene at that stage. In 1983, we had David Bohm and Rupert Sheldrake at the same conference. So David was talking about his implicate order, which I'll come back to, and then Rupert was obviously talking about morphic resonance. Now, I remember he had a white shirt on, and just white shirt and trousers, and he spoke without any notes in his usual lucid way, and quite captivating. And as it happens, I had a meeting with Rupert yesterday afternoon. But at that stage, I didn't know anything about new thought, which I'm going to explain a little to you later. I just arrived at these conclusions of oneness of mind, you know, through a process of looking at the Life Review. But before I just go into that a little bit, I want to look at the notion of expansion and contraction in relation to the cycles of life. And if you read literature on the development, the psychological and spiritual development of human beings, you start with a point where the baby is effectively psychically fused with the mother. And this was the sort of oceanic feeling that Freud based a lot of his understanding on. And then you have the notion of separation, individualization, self-centeredness, the development of the personality, which is in its more pathological end, if you like, and it represents contraction and anxiety and fear. And so I'm suggesting that the extreme individualization, and when you're cut off from everything, you know, it gives you this sense of separation. And then we're dominated by this sense of fear, which the media are hyping up every day, depending on which side of the Brexit thing, and anything else, and all the other things that are going on, whether it's terrorism or the European referendum. You know, fear is one of the main means of trying to persuade people to vote in the opposite direction. And then the process, I think, then moves through towards the moving beyond the personal, moving the self with a small s towards the self with a large s, the individuation process of Jung, going towards selflessness, towards universality, and towards love, towards compassion. And I may have got this wrong, but that's certainly that my experience of my own life is an evolution in this direction, towards the universal. So what Ravi Ravindra would call the first person universal, not the first person singular. And one of the things that I got out of that first conference from Ken Wilber was what he called the pre-trans fallacy, and where he said Freud didn't realize that mystical experience is talking about something beyond the ego, not pre the ego. And I think this is actually a very important, if rather dry, distinction. So we're talking about the trans-egoic here, and we're talking about what really happens in the second half of life. And looking around the room, I can see that most of us are actually in the second half of life, with a few notable exceptions. And so we're really beginning to grapple inwardly with these issues of going beyond ourselves, of growing into our full flowering, if you like, and really trying to actualize all the potential that's within us. Before we, as it were, run out of time. Although we don't want to feel in a hurry about doing this, because it's essentially a very slow maturation process, and a lot of it goes on in silence. It doesn't go on as a result of a huge amount of activity. So empathetic resonance, I coined this for the sense of feeling something in your body at a distance, which is an experience happening to someone else, and yet you have an immediate sense of it. And I'll give you an example. I was going to Manchester BBC to do an interview on near-death experiences, and I was taken there by a taxi driver, and I think the taxi driver did a lot of BBC work. And so he said, what have you been talking about? And I said, I'm talking about near-death experiences, and you know, and I'm very interested in this idea that sometimes people can feel things that are going on in other people's, in their own body, in other people. Oh, and he said, I know about that, because I'm a twin. And some of you who are twins here may have these experiences. And he said that he and his twin, they went off on a weekend together in a caravan with a family, so it was a bit cramped. And then his brother decided he wasn't going to stay the whole weekend in the caravan. He was going to go back. And so he got back to his house. And so the taxi driver is in his caravan bed about 11 o'clock at night on a Saturday. And suddenly he feels a blow to the head. And he thinks, oh, what's going on? You know, I'm fine. You know, I haven't just fallen out of my bunk or anything. And he thought of his brother. And so when he got back the next afternoon, he phoned him up and said, you know, you're okay? I said, well, I'm not completely okay, actually, because I had a few drinks last night and I sort of fell down the stairs about 11 o'clock at night and banged my head. And so this is an example, sort of a physical example, if you like, of being able to feel something that actually seems to be happening to someone else, or is happening to someone else, is verifiably happening to someone else, at the same time that you actually feel it. So if you start to ask yourself the question, well, as Peter used to put it, he would say, what's the mechanism? You know, how is this actually happening? And you have to start from the fact that it is happening, in the evidence base, if you like, and then ask yourself, well, what kind of world do we live in if this is what can happen? And the connection, I think, and this will be a no surprise to any of you here, the connection which enables this is a connection of love, connection of sympathy. So it's likely to happen between family members, spouses, partners, you know, people who are very close. And in fact, Rupert's telepathy experiments that he's done suggest that the people who are emotionally bonded get much higher scores on his telephone telepathy or text telepathy, again, as you would expect. And because if you're with someone for a long time, you know, your fields almost become one. And so it's really not surprising that this kind of capacity exists. And I remember talking to Helen, actually, quite a long time ago about this, because she may talk a little bit about this idea of doing intuitive diagnosis and others of you may have this experience as well, where you feel what's happening in somebody else's body because you feel it in your own. So again, it seemed to me this is the same kind of thing, which is why I call this empathetic resonance. It also happens with psychometry or object reading, where somebody, you can hold an object and then know something or get an insight into an experience that by the person to whom the object belongs. And if the object has belonged to several people, then an experienced psychometrist may be able to pick up experiences from each of the people who have owned the ring. If it's a family ring, it might have gone down the generations. And so that this seems to happen in physical distress, and it seems to happen with emotional distress. So another example would be that if a mother might get sympathetic labour pains when daughter is giving birth in a different place. And so there's a little bit of evidence of this. And I suspect if one dug into this a bit and did a bit more research, you'd probably find that a lot more of this is happening than we actually know about. I mean, just as good as straw poll, how many people have experienced something like this? Just to see. So quite a few. So, I mean, about 30%. Fascinating. Well, there'll be interesting conversations around the table. So then I arrived at the Life Review. And the Life Review, you'll know that it's part of the near-death experience, which is experienced by sort of maybe 10 to 15% of subjects. And when I dug into this, I found there were really two levels of Life Review. And the idea is that you see your life flashing in front of you. And that flashing in front of you idea, I call panoramic memory. And it doesn't involve any emotional involvement. You're not really feeling anything other than you're seeing a show and you've got all these memories flashing past. When you dig more deeply, then you get the Life Review proper, where it appears that all events that one experiences are multidimensional. And so just to take an obvious example, we're all at the same event here, but there's 130 of us or so, and so there are 130 different experiences of what it's like to be here and experience the event. And so if you were to experience the event in its entirety, you would have to experience what it was like to be each of us here, and then you would know what the event really was multidimensionally. And something like this seems to go on in the Life Review, so that when you review these experiences, then you not only feel them from your own point of view, and the feeling is the important thing, but you also feel them from the point of view of the other significant people involved. And as you can imagine, this could have an upside and a downside. And one of the things that just calls to mind, I've just reviewed this book called Vistas of Infinity for the new issue. And one of the vistas that this man came across was the afterlife condition of a suicide bomber. And you can't imagine what he described in this, because of the enormous suffering that this kind of event creates, not only for the people who are killed, but everybody else who's related to those people. And so the ramifications are absolutely enormous. And it was my belief in writing this book that if people knew this was that seemed to be a kind of law of the universe, that we re-experience things in order to learn from them, and that you'd think twice about doing one or two things. And you certainly wouldn't want to do something very destructive if you think, well, it's not, I'm going to experience that in the end, not the person. So it looks like this premise of separation, that we aren't other people, we aren't intrinsically related to other people, means that you can do things potentially which are harmful for them, and you don't think you're going to get harmed by it, but you are, because it just comes straight back in a loop. And so what this meant for me was that the oneness of mind just thinking through the logic of the life review, the oneness of mind had to be a postulate. You had to say there must be a deep level connection between each of us in order for this to be possible. Because if it is possible, then it is possible to experience what it's like to be someone else. And we can't do that by definition unless we share some level of mind or consciousness. And of course, that's really what we're exploring over the whole weekend. And this really suggests to me the sort of metaphysics and ethics of the Golden Rule, that if we are one another, then we can treat each other in a different way. If we have this sense of unity and connectedness with people rather than separation. This is Bain Saduno, Peter Dunoff, whose book, my book on him, Profit for Our Times, has just come out again, and there are some copies here with the books at the back. I have a dictation system, and so I dictate these things, at a capital P, cap Profit for Our Times. And you can imagine that in our very economic times, that when you dictate profit, it comes out P-R-O-F-I-T rather than profit. So Profit for Our Times, and then there's a quotation from him here. And so I had a section in this book, not only on the near-death experience life review, but on post-mortem reports of the same process. And so it seems like this is a kind of universal process. I may be wrong, and I'm quite prepared to be wrong, because if you hold on to your ideas too tightly and you find that reality is different from the ideas, you have to be able to adjust. And so this is his take on it, this examination of how you've applied the law of love. And this is a beautiful expression of it, because if really one of the underlying lessons of life is how do we apply the law of love, then this is the kind of learning outcome, if you like, if you want to put it in educational terms. So he talks about the film, really being confronted with yourself. That's what it is, confronted with yourself, and the corrections. And so if this is the case, then we need to reflect and concentrate on what we're saying and how we're saying it. So here you're an actor on stage being photographed and recorded all the time. Slightly worrying thought, really, isn't it? But if this really is how things unfold, then it's much better we know about it now than sort of find out a bit later in the game. Then the other aspect of this is the experience of cosmic consciousness, and I call this cosmic empathetic resonance. When you get this sense of expansion, and I'm sure many of you in this room will have experienced this, where your sense of self, the separated self, then is infused by these divine principles, the principles of light, love, peace, joy. And the light comes with understanding, but the understanding is also blissful. And so I talk a little bit about this in the book as well, because again, it seemed to me that this is another indication of this underlying oneness of mind. And I've got one or two quotations just sort of illustrate this idea. So first one is from Ralph Waldo Emerson. "We live in the lap of immense intelligence, which makes us receivers of its truth and organs of its activity." I love that. So we need to be receiving stations as well. And be open to inspiration and intuition. And then this, he talks about the oversoul, and there's an essay of his which is well worth reading if you don't know it, called The Oversoul. "We live in succession, in parts, in particles. Meanwhile, within man is the soul of the whole, the wise silence, the universal beauty, to which every part and particle is related, the eternal one." And that's really what we're talking about here, is trying to understand this more deeply. And by understanding it more deeply, then live more deeply from that sense of oneness, which he called the oversoul, and which Paul Brunton, who some of you may know, called the overself. It's a very similar idea. Then we come to a scientific formulation of it, with Schrödinger and Margano. And many of you have read Larry's article on Schrödinger and the oneness of mind, and he may talk about more about this tomorrow. So that's Schrödinger on the left and Henri Margonneau on the right. So I've got a couple of quotations here. And so this is coming at it from a kind of scientific angle, that the overall number of minds is just one. The multiplicity is only apparent, and truth is only one mind. And this, he was influenced by the Hindu view, I am that, which is being, consciousness, and bliss. And then Henri Margonneau, very similar, mystical writings of the great physicist. You know, it's something Ken Wilber wrote a book called Quantum Questions, which has all these quotations. Each of us is the universal mind, but inflicted with limitations that obscure all but a tiny fraction of its aspects and properties. And so we live life as if we're separate, when actually we aren't. David Bohm, and he's another person who expressed very similar ideas, and I was steeped in David Bohm at the time I was writing the book, because I just read Wholeness and the Implicate Order, which is an amazing book that came out in 1980. And there he is with Krishnamurti. That's okay. And here I think the hologram is a very good image for the connected nature of consciousness and the fact that the whole is reproduced in each of the parts. So David Bohm's ideas were undivided wholeness and flowing movement. The implicate order is the enfolded order where everything is interpenetrated and connected. And to implicate does mean enfolded, so it's folded in on itself. Whereas the explicate order is a manifest order, which is manifest, used like explaining, is you can hold it in your hand. It's something in manifest, hold it in your hand. So the manifest is the outer, where everything looks like it's separate. But, he said, the individual is actually embedded in the whole. And so the self is like a condensation in the field of being. And so our sense of separation as contracted individuals is one mode. It's the atomic mode, if you like, the individual mode. But we also have the wave mode, where we feel our intrinsic connectedness to the whole. Then another person who I've spoken about at conferences in the past, who understood this, was Walter Russell. And on the left, you can see him with his amazing bust of Mark Twain. He only started doing sculpting when he was in his 50s. He was a painter before that, and he was also a musician, architect, scientist, skater, horseman. And if you look him up, you'll be absolutely amazed at the diversity of his talent. And then that's one of his paintings on the right, which interestingly actually is called Dying Earth. And it's like a sort of giving out light. And it's slightly prophetic. I need to find out a little bit more about the background. But again, it's beautiful colours. You've got a cosmic infusion, I think, in his art. And he published this book. It's an incredible book, in 1928, called The Universal One. And it's based on a 3-week mystical experience he had when in 1921, when he was 50. And this is what he says here: all knowledge exists in the mind universe of light, so light and illumination, which is God. All mind is one mind. We do not have separate minds. All knowledge can be obtained from the universal source of all knowledge by becoming one with the source. And that actually is the key. So when people in near-death experiences or mystical experiences, when they are in the light, or they are the light, sorry, rephrase that, when they are the light, the entire universe makes sense. But then when they come back, they can't remember what the answer is to the meaning of the universe. Because it seems like we cannot grasp it with our rational mind. It requires something beyond the rational mind. And so he opened himself up to inspiration and intuition. And the knowledge of causes, which are the principles, as opposed to the effects, which is what you actually see in the physical world. And so this is what you might call deep science. And it's a science which is the science of the causal, of the mystical, of the one. Then we have Charles Harnell, who wrote an extraordinary book called The Master Key System. How many of you know The Master Key System? Just a handful. Well, you've got some interesting reading ahead of you. And so this is 1916, so this book is exactly 100 years old. And he says the same thing. There is one principle or consciousness pervading the entire universe. As this consciousness is omnipresent, it must be present within each individual. And each individual must be the manifestation of that omniscient, omnipotent, and omnipresent consciousness. Your consciousness is therefore identical with the universal consciousness. All mind is one mind. Each individual is the individualization of the universal, the cosmic mind. I think you're beginning to get the message. But the interesting thing, I think, is it reverses out your normal understanding, because I start anyway from my understanding of my own mind, and then I realize that actually my mind is simply a microcosm of something much larger. And so then you start from the center, or the self with a capital S, and then you realize that you are a similar center, and that you also can say, I am. And what can say, I am, in us, is precisely that divine center. And we can all say it. So we're all manifestations of this same principle. Thomas Troward was a circuit judge in India. And he retired in the late 1890s, and he's very famous for his Edinburgh lectures on mental science. And again, his work is quite extraordinary in terms of its detailed exposition, the logic of it, but also the rather remarkable experiences he describes, which I won't divert into any of those at the moment. I can tell you over lunch or whatever. So Thomas Troward, he said, the center of all being is also the center of our being. So what we feel ourselves, we experience ourselves as centers. At least I do. I imagine you do as well. And so we all experience ourselves as centers. And yet there's a center, transcendent center, which is the center, capital C, in all of us. And so the individuality, he suggests, is the complement to the universal. The universal has to be universal. It can't be individual. And the individual can tap into the universal. And so he's saying that the problem of life is to find the relationship between yourself, your own consciousness, and the universal consciousness. And that's what he calls the great self-recognition of our relation to the Supreme Mind, that it is the generating center, the creative center, and we are distributing or receiving centers. And again, I rather like that idea of being a distributing center, that I can plug in, we can all plug in through inspiration and intuition, and then receive these thoughts and express them and put them out or put them onto paper. So this is a summary, if you like, of the new thought view. That is one of the primacy of the inner, primacy of consciousness. Mind is fundamental and creative. Consciousness is universal and omnipresent. And this is the model that I think, you know, we're all moving towards, and I'm sure Larry will say more about this tomorrow. We are that universal mind or consciousness. And creative thoughts are externalized, so that as within, as without. So it means that the real world, the creative world, is the world of thought. Because as you look around yourself here, all the technology, the tables, the chairs, everything started as a thought. And so the process of understanding has to be from the inside out, not from the outside in. And so these thinkers suggest this threefold understanding of the mind, where you have the conscious mind as the kind of pilot, if you like, the subconscious subjective mind, and then the superconscious subjective universal, which is what we can tap into and which we are actually part of. And so I haven't really got time to go into the mechanics of this, but it's through this superconscious that we seem to be related intrinsically to the universal mind, and we can then enter into a co-creative relationship with the universal mind. But it requires focus and direction. And so if your mind is not focused and having a sense of direction, then the energy doesn't know which way to flow. But you have a receptive mode where you receive the ideas and inspiration. Then there's a focus mode where you start thinking it through, and then it can manifest in your life. And so this, the thought concentrated on purpose becomes power. And we set in motion, by our own participation, this creative power of the universal mind. So this is an amazing thought. And these people, Russell, Harnell, Troward, they all did this with some extraordinary results. And so the point I'm getting to here, is as expressed by Harnell, is that the power is within, the creative power is within. And so the world outside is a reflection of what's going on inside. And that applies generally to our world situation at the moment, that what we're seeing on the outside corresponds to what's on the inside in terms of thoughts and feelings. And he observes here, a majority of mankind lives in the world without, and few have found the world within. It is the world within that makes the world without. And I think three years ago, I gave a talk including the work of my architect grandfather, Sir Robert Lorimer. And the architect is, you know, archetypally the person who has a creative idea, a design, puts it down on paper. The builder looks at the two-dimensional and produces the three-dimensional. And so you get the building, the Thistle Chapel, the Scottish National War Memorial, emerging out of these series of connected ideas. Troward puts this point very clearly, that we are all creative centres of our own world, and the correspondence between the inner and the outer. And thus, he says, the creative order is from states, which is your inner state, to outer conditions. And so I think it's very important to understand this dynamic of the creativity from within being expressed without, because our whole culture is so extroverted that we all think everything is, the reality of everything is outside ourselves. And that's one of the reasons I do this work with young people, because I want them to understand that their power is within, that their creativity is within, that they can make something of their lives through the kind of thoughts and the kind of feelings and kind of actions that they perform. And it's important, there are two things, aspects of this, which are very important. One is understanding the law of growth, which is the creative force throughout nature. And this is Troward here. And so it's the seed attracting to itself the necessary elements for its growth. And the same happens with an idea. And you may have had experience of this. You start with a small idea, and then somebody mentions something, and then, oh yeah, that's interesting, and then something happens, and it sort of starts connecting up, and before you know where you are, it really is germinating, and you can run with this, and something new emerges in your life. So this includes people and events, which then they create synchronicities, which enable new things to happen. And then the same applies, then the desire, if you like, the feeling, the desire is the motor, the engine, if you like. Now, desire can get a very bad press. And, you know, you have to, in Buddhism, you have to be desireless, you know, not have any desires at all. And yet, you know, if we didn't desire things, I mean, Augustine, his overriding desire, once he'd sublimated his sexual appetites, was for God. And so the mystic has this transcendent desire for God. And so I don't think we should give desire a bad press. I think we should be able to refine and purify and express our desires in a good, purposeful direction. And so I like this particular definition. Desire is the mind seeking to manifest itself in some form which as yet exists only in thought. And that's the emotional part of the desire. Plant, grow, ripen, harvest. Yeah. Okay? So just coming to the end here, this is a Walter Russell painting, where he talks, it's all things return to their source. There you have, in the painting, you have this unfolding process, which is what's happening in the spring. And I'll explain this with Panya and Panyarrhythmia for people who want to know about this tomorrow. But then you also have the refolding process, which is the process, the life expresses itself. So this is the outward manifestation. And death refolds into the one, or into the larger identity, or into the deeper identity, into the soul. So the personality expresses itself out of this deeper root and then returns to the root. So just summing up what I've been trying to say, I believe that we are all expressions of the one universal mind, and I'm sure everybody will they'll be reinforcing this message. Plotinus put it, we are within a reality that is also within us. And that means that we are at a deep level, one another. And that has huge ethical implications, in my view, and suggests that the golden rule, profoundly, is applying the law of love, which Peter Dunoff was talking about in that slide I gave you. And that leads to what I call an ethic of interconnectedness. Science is showing how everything is interconnected, whether it's physics, collective unconscious, biology, symbiosis, ecology, systems theory. It's all all these patterns of interconnectedness are coming up. And so the idea of splendid isolation is now out of date. And so I'm saying that the insights of the near-death experience, the life review, the empathetic resonance means that we need to realize this sense of oneness and then act accordingly. So thank you very much indeed.
Well, David, thank you so much for that. We have time for a few questions. Yes. The back.
That's a very interesting question. Of course, it comes from somebody who wrote a book called Spiritual Psychiatry. I think it's a question of boundaries. I think what you're getting at here, because somebody said the difference between a mystic and a psychotic is they're both swimming in the same sea, but one of them is drowning. It's a matter that not having boundaries is a problem, but having rigid boundaries is equally a problem. So it's getting it right. And I think what's quite interesting, just this sort of reflects, is that some near-death experiencers will say that after the near-death experience, they become so sensitive to what's happening to other people, that they get sort of invaded by this, and of course that's not a desirable situation to be in. So we need boundaries, but we also need this underlying sense of connectedness that I've been suggesting.
You made reference to the chairs and the tables being created by thought. How far back do you take that thought? Was it the tree that thought it wanted to be a tree? Or were you thinking of the individual that decided to create the table?
Yes, I was thinking the latter, but a sort of esoteric understanding of creation would be that everything that is created is a thought of the divine, which is maybe what you were sort of getting at behind that. And so, it's obviously not... it's not equivalent, but there must be some parallel, because it seems to me that nature operates in the same way at every level. So if one can understand the creative process at one level, you can then get a bit of an understanding as how it might work at other levels.
Yes.
David, if you are... I think what you're saying is that we're... Hello.
Oh, sorry. I'm lost you.
We're participants in the universe rather than observers. This is very much close to my heart. And I've heard other speakers say that we can harness the power of our thought, feeling, and emotion and affect the world. Is that where you're coming from as well? Where I've heard research where a very small proportion of...
meditators or...
Yes, yeah. People who are just projecting, participating in a better future can have an enormous effect. What do you think of that?
Well, yes, I mean, it slightly reminds me of the question from going back to 1992 when somebody asked Father Bede, you know, what was the solution to the problems of the world? And he said, meditation. And I think what we could do is I'm thinking here of the silent minute, you know, which happened during the Second World War, and that I think the power of coordinated thought, and there's some evidence of this from Princeton, isn't there, from the Roger Nelson's work, is immense. And so a few years ago, I had this idea, which was never really sort of materialized. This, when I went to a conference in Sweden, and I found this beautiful crystal heart. I don't know whether any of you have seen that. And it fits a nightlight in the middle. And so it's the heart of light. And so I thought, well, you know, if thousands of people bought one of these things, of course, it's not necessary to have the heart of light. You can just have a night light or a candle. You know, don't need to. But if one coordinated the lighting of the candle with, as Sir George used to say, he said, "We send out the light and the love." He always did this at the end when the candle was being blown out at the end of Mystics and Scientists conference. And so I think something like this, if we coordinated that over the internet, which one could easily have a Facebook page and all the rest of it, and maybe just start in a small way and grow it, it could be very powerful. And I'll just mention one other thing, because it's a similar idea. I don't know how many of you have been to Teze, or went to Teze, which I did in the 1980s. And on the Saturday evening, there's what they call the resurrection service. And so everybody who goes in gets a candle. And at the beginning of the service, there's only one candle alight. And that candle lights the next candle, which lights the next candle light. And within 5 minutes, the whole church is ablaze with light. Similar kind of thing. So I think rather than arguing around the negotiating table, that some symbolic coordinated action like this might do a lot more good, or maybe get all the people who are arguing to do panarrhythmy. You know, I think that would also have an effect. You'll find out about that. So yes is the answer. Thank you.
Okay, well, we have 5 minutes now. Perhaps you'd like to elect a leader at each table. You'd like to turn to each other and make your comments about the talk. And then, Paul, how are they going to get them up onto the web?
Well, hopefully the leader can put them on the web for us. But if that doesn't work and you want to pass a piece of paper our direction, then we will do that for you.
Okay, I think that we probably should draw this part to a conclusion now. And so we come to the last part of the evening, which is an important part, because this is the time when the speakers are going to introduce themselves to you, and each one is going to take about 2 minutes to say what they're going to talk about. Now, what is the point of that? The point of that is that not everybody always stays for the whole conference. And so hearing what is going to happen and who's going to talk about what means that you can talk to the speakers before you go. So it's quite a vital part. So I suggest that we start in the order that we are. And so it's going to be... Helen, give me your name, Helen.
Dr. Helen Ford.
Thank you, Helen. That's really good. Now then, tell us who you are and what you're going to talk about all in about 2 or 3 minutes.
Okay, I'm trained as a medical doctor. I kind of came to the conclusion that people were ill because of what was going on underneath in their emotions and got interested in that. And I now work as, I call it a holistic physician. But really what I do is read auras. Because the aura has information about everything that's happened to you, and if you ask a specific question of the aura, it can bring up the relevant information to understand that problem. It's like, you know, looking for a needle in a haystack, but if the person writes a request for what they want, the aura will select certain scenes, and those scenes will come up, and they will explain exactly why they've got the problem that they've got and what they can do about it. It's good. I don't know how it works. But it's good. And nice stories. I was saying to somebody earlier, one of the nice things is that every story that I get to experience through somebody else's memories, there are other people's memories that I'm experiencing with the feelings and the visuals that go with them, but it's actually a memory I'm going into. They all have happy endings potentially. If the person does what their soul wants them to do, they'll have a happy ending. If they go on doing whatever they're doing, they won't. But at least I know there could be a happy ending. So that makes me happy, because I'll never finish a book if it doesn't have a happy ending. If it looks bad, I'm getting towards the end. I think, no, not going to read this. Put it down. Mostly I can tell. It's quite a good handy trick, because I go into the video shop, you know, and go through them and pick a number and then shut my eyes. Yeah, no, don't want that. And the ones I put away, I invariably found out didn't have happy endings. So it's all right. Didn't mind. So basically what I'm going to be doing is talking about... I totally agree with everything David said, but that's about the soul. Now, the soul inhabits a body, and the difficulties that come for us are because we've got a body. Because the body's got a completely different agenda, which is survival, you know, reproduction, you know, supporting the tribe or the race or whatever. So that's all going on, and the body also has a whole load of interesting reflex patterns related to the survival and everything, which go on a lot in the subconscious. So the soul, the intent of the soul to express itself, can be quite severely inhibited by the physical patterns that are going on. So that's what I've studied over the years, and that's what I'm going to talk about and explain. But I'm also, I'm going to try and show you how to, if anybody's interested. Well, I'll ask what people want to do in the workshop, and somebody said they'd like to see auras. I can easily show you that. But... anything else anybody's interested? You better let me know. Okay.
Okay, thanks. Thanks very much, Helen. Okay. That's great. Now, Maya, do you tell us who you are and what you're going to talk about?
My name is Maya de Vries. I'm coming from the Netherlands, and I will talk about universal laws. I came across the universal laws because I asked the question, how can we discern what works and what does not work? Because many things in the world right now does not work the way we want them to work. And so we want to have things working differently. But if we start doing things differently without knowing if those different things will work, it's maybe a big loss of energy. So if we can first discern what works and what doesn't work, we can consciously choose to do that what works, and that saves a lot of energy, and we can use the universal laws for this. I found the universal laws as the underlying truths of all wisdom traditions, not just of one wisdom traditions, but of all. And once I found that, I was curious to find out whether new cutting-edge discoveries of science were on the way of finding the same truths, and that was a very exciting job to do, because I found many very new insights in science that are much more in line with those universal laws than what we have thought before for a long time. So, of course, I cannot explain this all in detail in my talk, but I will try to summarize it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Raya. Tom, tell us who you are.
Does this one work? Yes, it does. Thanks very much for inviting me. This is my first Mystics and Sciences Conference, so I'm a bit of a newbie here, so I'm wide-eyed and enjoying it so far. My name is Tom McLeish. I'm a professor of physics at Durham University. Anyone been? Well, we're asking questions, aren't we? Everyone been to Durham? Anyone who been? Yeah, wonderful. Anyone not been to Durham? In the words of Bill Bryson, go to Durham. Go. The most ancient spiritual seat of learning in the entire kingdom. And it's a privilege to be working on physics in the shadow of the cathedral and castle that's known scholarship for more than and spirituality for more than 1,000 years. No, it really is. Everyone loves that place. So I'm a scientist. I'm also an Anglican lay reader. So I know what you're thinking. You don't get much more orthodox than this chap. And I may well be a bit too straight for you, but we'll see, won't we? One thing that I'm passionate about is the human long story of science. And one thing I hate is the completely made-up, ridiculous story that science and religion are necessarily in conflict with each other. But I've decided that it's no good hitting that argument head-on, because people don't believe it when you do that. So instead, I wrote a book a couple of years ago called Faith and Wisdom in Science, which I support myself out into and wanted to show that science is actually in continuity with an ancient human story that is as old as cave painting and music and song and myth and religion, and is all part of the healing our relationship with the world. It's called Faith and Wisdom in Science. I've got a few copies with me. And the reason I'm saying that now is because I'm not going to talk about that at all tomorrow. I'm actually going to talk about non-locality. But I'm not going to talk about, I thought that it might help to do the sort of things that physics do. Physicists make our trade by simply not doing hard problems. We run away from hard problems, we do easy problems instead. I'm giving away secrets of the trade here, aren't I? Yeah, other physicists here are nodding. You see, before you can understand non-locality in the mind, you need to understand non-locality in anything. So what I thought I'd do is how we do it. You know, before we do really difficult things, before you launch a rocket to the moon, you know, you launch a rocket up 100 feet from your backyard, don't you? And then you launch higher and higher ones. So given that non-locality has a difficult press anywhere, I thought I'd talk about two recent discussions in physics where we are beginning to understand real non-locality. One is a quantum weirdy thing, and one is a piece of research in my own area, soft matter and sticky fluids, polymers, when the molecules are made of rings. I won't explain more now, but it comes from a project called the Durham Emergence Project. So if that means anything to you, or a few little hooks there, that's what's going to happen tomorrow.
That's great. Larry, tell us who you are and what you're going to talk about.
Well, I'm Larry Dawsey, and I'm a repeater here, and thanks for the invitation to come back. One never knows if one will get an invitation to return, but I am really grateful for it. Unlike David, I don't speak very many languages. I'm still struggling with English, as you will probably have evidence for. I'm an internal medicine physician, and I recently published a book called One Mind, How Our Individual Mind is Part of a Greater Consciousness and Why That Matters. And I think the considerations of non-locality of consciousness inevitably get us into considerations of spirituality. And it is astonishing, in my view, that the degree of re-spiritualization in medicine, at least in the colonies, is just enormous. You cannot now get a medical degree from any MD-granting higher institution of learning in the United States without demonstrating that you understand how spirituality can be used as a conduit for the delivery of compassion, empathy, and love to the people you serve. If you own a hospital or a clinic, in order for it to be accredited, you have to have a vehicle in place in order to assess the spiritual health of every patient coming into your hospital. It is now clear that spirituality creates an enormous contribution to human health. We know from immense evidence that people who follow a spiritual path in their life live from 7 to 14 years longer than people who do not. This is huge. It has become clear to most medical educators that we are no longer justified in omitting in medical education considerations of spirituality. What I'm going to demonstrate to you, I think, in my talk is that considerations of spirituality and non-locality of consciousness are literally a matter of life and death. I think it's time that we elevated this idea of non-local unitary mind from the level of metaphor to the level of empirical fact. I can summarize what I'm going to say by referring to the best book review I've ever had in my life, which was given by my mother back in 1982 when my first book, Space, Time, and Medicine, came out. Someone asked my mother, "What do you think about Larry's new book?" And without any hesitation, she said, "Well, I can't understand a word of it, but if my boy wrote it, it's right." I'm just going to talk to you all tomorrow and the next day about what's right.